Hey everyone, this is Dr. Smith, and today is the lecture on the current Korean political system, specifically speaking about the Republic of Korea, otherwise known as, more commonly, of course, South Korea. And what we're going to do is just go over the broad strokes of the current institutional design of Korea. Take this into account with the readings I've assigned you as well. But bear in mind this, and this is not insignificant. With Korea, it's very important with all of these institutions to remember some things about its recent experiences. One is, of course, Korea was occupied by the Japanese for decades. Along with Taiwan, it experienced an intensive phase of industrialization that was still imperialistic under the Japanese kind of period of rule. This undoubtedly left marks that are going to permanently influence the Koreans, both in the sense of like it's going to influence them in ways that they are conscious of and oftentimes do want to imitate. I mean, the Japanese clearly developed an effective model of development and democratization, but also in the sense of a conscious desire to not imitate whenever possible. The Japanese are still not particularly well-loved, shall we say, in South Korea. So these are things to bear in mind, as well as, of course, the fact that after the Japanese occupation ended with the end of World War II, Korea was split in the Korean War. It experienced a very long, extended, very violent war, kind of like I've often heard it referred to by Americans as like the Forgotten War. It's the war between Vietnam and World War II that we just don't spend enough time discussing. A truly horrific experience that had lasting effects on South Korean development, not the least of which is for decades the preeminence of the military and intelligence services in Korea, which still from time to time, even as recently as about, say, 10 years ago, were very active in intervening in Korean politics. And as still, we don't see actually the active democratization of Korea as fait accompli till around the period of the revolutions of 89 through 92, when so many different first communist, but then also military-dominated authoritarian states democratized. Importantly with this is the if you're really interested in looking up the period of intelligence and military domination, go down the Google chain and look up the KCIA, the Korean CIA, exactly what it sounds like, and also look at the NIS, the National Intelligence Service, interference in the 2010s. Specifically where it was interfering with elections to try and help guarantee the Conservative Party remained the dominant party in Korean politics. So we're going to take this step by step and break down the key institutions of the Korean system. I think you'll see that there are any number of different institutions that are kind of parallel with those of other kind of mid-century democratizing states. And late democratizing states. So, you know, states that have democratized in the, say, 1950s to 2000s. So first off, we have, it's important to bear in mind, Korea is a unitary state. It's highly centralized. This makes sense, of course. It's culturally fairly uniform. It's ethnically fairly uniform. Most immigration into Korea is from, actually, refugees from North Korea, though there are refugees and immigrants from other places. It's overwhelmingly culturally Korean in Korea. We also see that Korea is geographically fairly small. You know, it's not that big a state geographically, so that level of cultural uniformity is not really surprising or shocking in any way, shape, or form. Even though it is a very deep and rich culture, I'm not trying to in any way undermine that or undermine the importance of localities and provincial differences historically in Korea. But that said, you look at it on the map and your gut instinct, and you know anything about the demography, your gut instinct is to assume rightly that it is a unitary state. That means, of course, that subnational institutions are largely administrative And there is some degree of democratic deficit in South Korea in terms of local and regional institutions. Again, not that unusual, but its democracy ratings are pretty high. I was looking at it, typically kind of comes in between 20 and 25 on the different ratings in terms of most democratic state on earth. Major problems are bureaucratic interference with elections, and again, the democracy deficit in local and mid-range politics are all kind of relevant. So, first off, let's talk about the executive branch. And the reason I want to talk about the executive branch instead of the legislative branch first is it's actually kind of an intriguing hybrid that I'm just kind of excited to talk about. So we have a president and a prime minister in South Korea. The president is elected for a single five-year term by direct popular vote. Now, why one term? It's as you would expect. Like so many of the things we're going to see that are standout kind of institutional characteristics, this is really the effect of a holdover, if you will, from trying to prevent a reemergence of bureaucratic authoritarianism in the Korean state, especially, of course, military-dominated, but any type of bureaucratic. So authoritarianism, or authoritarianism in general. So the limitation, the strict limitation on when heads of state can, or how long heads of states can rule is not too surprising there. Now, there is also a prime minister. The prime minister is appointed by the president. So the president is the head of state. The prime minister is technically head of government. But what we see is that this is a very strong hybrid system in terms of its lean towards the presidency. Some hybrid systems, it's pretty much the executive power is split 50-50. Others, the president is very weak and really holds a role that's comparable to like a kind of hereditary monarch in a constitutional monarchy. In this case, what we see is the president is actually the dominant figure. And so in many ways, it looks like some of the more effective democracies in Latin America, if you're familiar with those. So I find that quite interesting. The president's role, let's talk about that. One, the president is the commander-in-chief. So that's a good sign that the president's going to have real authority for no, unsurprisingly, right? The commander-in-chief. The president is also the person who appoints the prime minister. Now, this is interesting. The prime minister does not have to be a member of parliament. And in fact, the prime minister does not have to be a member of a party or even the ruling party. But the prime minister does have to be approved by the National Assembly, by the parliament of South Korea. So the prime minister is still subject to parliamentary authority, but is not necessarily a parliamentarian or even of the dominant party. You would assume that'd be easier if it's someone of the dominant party, but I find that very interesting. That's an interesting artifact. The president also appoints and presides over the cabinet, if you will, the State Council of Korea. And the State Council is basically the key bureaucratic oversight point in the Korean system. It is where you would assume, because it is a hybrid parliamentary presidential system, it is not only the key go-between the constitutional executive branch, but also the constitutional legislative branch. But again, we'll see that, the ministers that make up State Council do not necessarily have to come from Parliament any more than the Prime Minister does. So that's interesting. But we'll get into that in a minute. The President has the power to declare war. And that's obviously quite significant. Now, this declaration of war has to be with parliamentary approval. But still, I always find it interesting when a state gives the power of war declaration to an executive rather than to the legislature. Rather than calling it simple proclamation. Oy vey, guys, it's been a day. This is my second long lecture, so here we go. The president also has legislative initiative. Now, the entire state council has legislative initiative, but the president, by virtue of dominating the state council, is regarded as having that legislative initiative, him or herself. The president has a veto power in South Korea, and it's a strong veto power, so bills can be vetoed by the president, To overturn a veto, the reason you can tell it's a strong veto power requires a two-thirds supermajority vote in the National Assembly. So that's comparable to the United States, with the exception of, because we're going to see it's a unicameral legislature, that's probably theoretically a little easier to get than in a bicameral legislature. Even though we do have a parliament element to this system, there is no power of dissolution. Neither the president nor the prime minister can dissolve the National Assembly. So that is a key limitation. Again, you would expect that in a post-authoritarian democracy, or a modern post-authoritarian, like a democracy that's trying to avoid slipping back into bureaucratic authoritarianism. Oh, how many ways can I rephrase that? Impeachment in the South Korean state is done by the National Assembly, and then is sent to the Constitutional Court for confirmation. And the way that that takes place, if the president is going to be impeached, the president, first off, a majority of the members of the National Assembly have to agree to the proposal. Then they vote on it formally after having hearings. And if the hearings are approved, then it takes a two-thirds supermajority for that approval. So it's a very interesting thing. So a majority to bring the bill to the National Assembly, a two-thirds supermajority to pass it, then it's actually sent to the Constitutional Court for consideration to make sure it's done in done with propriety and good faith and legally. So that's a very interesting thing, the fact that like a legislative referendum on impeachment can be prevented, and has historically, this has actually happened in South Korea, has been prevented by the Constitutional Court. It's been overturned. So if there's a vacancy in the presidency, the prime minister runs the executive branch by him or herself until that vacancy is filled. Either the president recovers if they're just sick or injured, or the vacancy is filled by an election. The prime minister doesn't have the ability to rule to run this. The prime minister, of course, not being directly elected. So is even though he has this power, or she has this power that is comparable to the vice president, it is a limited term power. So basically, if the president's not going to recover or they've been impeached, you have to have an election within 60 days. If the election doesn't, when the election takes place, then the prime minister concedes power to the new president. So the president is directly elected, as opposed to the prime minister, who is, in essence, an appointee of the president with legislative approval. That's kind of why the Koreans have designed it in this way. I like this. I like this better than our way of doing it with a vice president. Call me crazy. The president has pardoning powers, nothing too crazy there. The president, of course, has a power to declare a state of emergency, which allows the president to then enact in limited areas or across the country the state of martial law, military rule. Not too crazy, nothing too surprising there. But this is particularly important in the case of South Korea when you remember that it lives in a state of near perpetual, very high tension at minimum with North Korea, with the People's Democratic Republic of Korea. So, and the National Assembly, I kind of like this. The National Assembly has the power to void any presidential action, any kind of like executive decision, through a simple majority vote. So if the president makes issues a executive order and the National Assembly is like, that's BS, it only takes a simple majority to overturn that, which I find very interesting. I kind of like that. Now, the State Council, which is, again, the cabinet, is appointed by the president, and confirmed members are confirmed by the National Assembly. Now, it's overwhelmingly made up of ministers and other kinds of leaders of the bureaucracy. Some of these may be parliamentarians. Others may be party-affiliated, that is to say, they're politicians. And yet others may be independent and are technocrats. So it's really a fusion of different types of cabinets, both technocratic and political. And its membership can vary. It can have between 15 and 30 members. Just to give you a sense, now there was just an election, of course, and that election is kind of an overwhelming win for the party in power, and it's going to be interesting to see how that shakes out, actually. But right before the moment where I recorded this, there were currently 18 members of the South Korean State Council. Of those 18 members, 13 of them were independent technocrats. They were not party men and party women. So I think that's very interesting. That's going to change quite a bit in the near future. But, you know, there you go. The prime minister, on the other hand, is the head of government. And again, appointed by the president with National Assembly approval. Again, there was no requirement that he or she be a member of the National Assembly, which is interesting. If you've taken Southern European politics, this sort of reminds me of like the emergency conditional prime ministers or premiers that you see in like Greece. It's a way of making sure government functions, even when you have rather nasty politics at play. And again, I don't necessarily dislike this. I think it's an interesting institution. Sometimes the prime minister is regarded as analogous to the American vice president. In other ways, it's regarded as kind of a chief assistant to the president. Since the vice president, since the prime minister has this title of head of government, and they are in charge of institutions of managing the government, then what that means is that they do have, there's an expectation that they're going to have direct administrative powers. So it is a position that I would regard as, at least constitutionally speaking, more powerful than the vice president. The vice president's actual power in the United States is dependent upon the will of the president, who chooses to employ them or not employ them, typically. South Korea also has two deputy prime ministers. And for the prime minister to be impeached, it takes a one-third nomination from the National Assembly and a majority to confirm it. So it's a much lower standard for impeachment of a prime minister. No surprise there. That makes a lot of sense, given the prime minister is supposed to be an animal both of the executive and legislative branches in any given system. Now, just to give you a sense of like how the authority, at least in theory, is divided up. The prime minister is over the administration, direct administration of the ministries and independent agencies, but the president has a number of different offices that he or she directly administers without it necessarily coming under the aegis of the prime minister. A couple of these that are worth noting are the Presidential Security System, the Office of National Security, the Board of Audit and Inspection, the Korean Communications Commission, the National Human Rights Commission of Korea, and then the agency we mentioned earlier as having interfered in previous elections, not unproblematically, the National Intelligence Service. So there are a number of different very powerful bodies that are directly under the control of the president, and the prime minister isn't necessarily have direct oversight over at all, which is, again, an indication of the imbalance, not necessarily the intended imbalance. I'm not trying to imply it's a mistake or whatever. The imbalance in terms of presidential versus prime ministerial power in this hybrid system. So that leads us into the design of the legislature. What's the legislature of South Korea look like? The National Assembly is how it's normally translated. The formal term is Gukho. I don't speak Korean, guys, at all. Gukho, I think, is how it would be said. And it's an interesting body. It's got 300 members who are elected for four-year terms. But these 300 members are elected. It is a fusion or a hybrid system. So in that way, it kind of looks like post-reform Japan. This fusion system, 253 of the members of the National Assembly are elected in first-past-the-post single-seat constituencies. Now, if you've taken comparative politics, you know exactly what that means. First-past-the-post, whoever gets the plurality in a certain constituency wins. Single seat, it's only one person per constituency. So the vast majority of people elected into the National Assembly are elected in a way that resembles nothing more dramatic than our House of Representatives. On the other hand, but this is on a national scale, obviously. It's not, the constituencies are divided nationally. There's no particular rhyme or reason that is dependent upon the states particularly. So, on the other hand, 47 of the members of the National Assembly are elected by means of national proportional representation. In other words, the classic model of, like, if you get, let's see, in the 47, you need a little bit, right around 2% of the vote, then your party is going to be getting a seat in Parliament. So there's, I haven't seen anything that says they're using any, like, D'Hondt variation or anything like that. So it seems like it's probably a simple proportionality, which makes sense given that the proportional element is actually such a small part, relatively speaking, of the overall National Assembly, to just go with a straightforward, easy-to-understand proportional mechanism. You have to be 19 years old to vote in National Assembly elections in Korea, and 25 to run for an office in the National Assembly. Now, there's some things that are really interesting about the Korean National Assembly. The head of part, well, all right, let's actually get the boring ones done first before I dive into, like, the really cool stuff. The head of parliamentary procedure is a speaker. No surprise there. There is also a secretariat of the National Assembly led by a secretary general. And like any secretariat, it exists largely to do business for the assembly. It exists to help it do its job, in essence. It also has a really interesting kind of quorum for proceedings. It's quorum for proceeding, that is to just like do regular business, is 1/5 of the total membership. And then the resolution type determines what the quorum is for actually voting on a resolution. So the more important the resolution is, the higher the quorum is. But for doing business, only 1/5, that's pretty surprising. They also have a limit on how soon bills that have been voted down can be reconsidered. So if a bill is voted down during one legislative session, it cannot be reconsidered until the next legislative session. So basically the next year. There are 17 standing committees. Ooh, this is where it gets exciting. There are 17 standing committees in the Korean Parliament. But these committees are kind of interesting. We're going to see how they function as a little unique. There's a special standing committee on budget and accounts, which has members from all the other standing committees. And there are, the allotment of membership in committees is determined by something called negotiation groups. Now, that's the special thing I was excited to tell you about. Let's talk about it. Now, the Korean system has very low party loyalty, very low party discipline. There's frequent reorganization of parties. If you look up some charts on parties and representative and how parties split and open, it'll blow your mind. It's worth a Google search. And of course, you should see it in your readings as well. But the party discipline is really low in Korea. People tend to vote with a mind of trying to elect an individual. The party members move from party to party very fluidly. Parties collapse and form and reorganize. And yet you still have to get things done, right? To me, this is very interesting. It's a wonderful example of how culture, the role culture can play in the way legislative politics unroll. And the way that Korea deals with this is they have a principle of negotiation groups. A negotiation group is formed when any party has more than 20 members, so 20 plus members, or can be formed by any group of parliamentarians who come together and declare themselves a negotiation group as long as there are 20 or more in that group. So this is important because not only do negotiation groups tend to function as the mechanism of negotiation for the development and amending of bills, but the appointment to standing committees is done by proportion, not of parties, but of negotiation groups. So some parties, that is effectively the same thing. For others, it is not. So negotiation groups, even though they're this very, I don't know, this very squishy thing compared to a lot of like traditional democratic legislative politics, they are critical to the way the Korean legislature functions. So as of the last election, the most recent election, that is the one that led into yesterday's, the day before I recorded this, the negotiation groups divided up as in this sense. I got this right from the Korean National Assembly website. So we have the Democratic Party of Korea has 120 members in parliament, and that means their negotiation group has 120 members. That means they're about 40, just shy of 41.5% of the total membership. And so in any committee, that party slash negotiation group will receive just shy of, 42% of the membership. The United Future Party has 92 members, and that means that in any committee, it's going to get about 30, just shy of 32% of the membership in every committee. The another party, the Minsangdong Party, I believe is how you'd say that, has 20 members, and they're going to have 6.9%, so just barely shy of 7% in every committee. And the Future Korea Party, 20 members as well, 7%. And then all the other members in the legislature have together, that leaves 31 independent and very small party members. Those do not make up, they do not constitute a negotiation group. They could have formed into one or several. Well, there would have been, at most you would have had one, I suppose. But hypothetically, let's say it was a bigger proportion, it would be several. But these independents and these small parties, they did not form into a negotiation group. So basically what happens is they are going to be appointed. They're going to be appointed basically in conference with the prime minister, and I believe the speaker's involved as well. So, but everybody, from what I've gathered, it does look like everyone gets to serve on at least one committee. So that's kind of interesting. Now, how does this legislature devise and alter the law? There's two major methods that I think warrant. There's like a generic law passage, and there's a constitutional amendment process. And then, of course, there's the treaty process. So let's talk about the normal legal process, too. So first off, we have bill initiation, like who starts the bill. Bills can be initiated either by the government, that is to say the president or the state council, or they can be initiated by members of the National Assembly. Now, for members of the National Assembly to initiate a bill, and this is interesting, it requires a minimum of 10 plus signatures. So at least 10 members of the National Assembly have to support a bill for it to be submitted to the speaker for consideration. The speaker then, of course, determines, from then it looks a lot like the American system, is going to send it to committee, it may get sent to subcommittees, may get sent to multiple committees. The one committee that any bill that is going to get voted on in plenary session is going to have to go to is the legislation and judiciary, the legislation and judiciary committee, which checks the wording and basically tries to make sure it's consistent with other laws and the Constitution. And then the bill goes before plenary vote if it makes it out of committee for consideration and vote. If the bill is passed by the National Assembly as a whole, it's then sent to the president. Now, the president, of course, can veto it or can promulgate it. If it's vetoed, the speaker then has the option of sending it for veto overturn process, basically, to give the National Assembly, the option to overturn the veto and possibly install this as law over the protest of the president. Now, this is different than before we go into the Constitution, let's actually talk about treaties. Treaties are basically, in Korea, their legal structure argues that determines treaties as having the same effect as law. So they are equivalent to law without requiring further legal action by the legislature. So what that means is that any treaty after negotiation still has to be consented to by the National Assembly. So in essence, it is as the National Assembly is playing a lot of roles that look like the House of Representatives and a lot of roles that look like the Senate. Not surprising in a unicameral legislature. Nothing too crazy there. Now, amending the Constitution is quite interesting in a system like this because it is, A, you have a real fear of amendments to the Constitution undermining the democratic impulse. There's a real fear of slipping back into bureaucratic authoritarianism. B, we have a unicameral legislature and we have a unitary system. That means a lot of the mechanisms countries like the United States have, which have multiple state legislatures and also have a bicameral legislature, to basically parse and slow down the process of constitutional revision aren't present in South Korea. So the question is going to be, how do they try to make sure that any kind of amendment remains democratic and it retains a character that's acceptable to the whole nation? All right, so what does this mean? Well, it means that for a constitutional amendment to be considered for adoption, it has to be proposed by a majority of the National Assembly. Then it is publicly published within 20 days. So it is proposed by a majority, it's published within 20 days for public consideration. Everybody gets to talk about it, contact their leaders, etc. After 60 days, it is then voted on by the National Assembly again. For it to pass, it requires a supermajority of 2/3 of the National Assembly to support it. Okay? Nothing too crazy there. Sounds very familiar. But then we get something interesting that I also kind of like. After 30 days, once it's 30 days after it's been approved by the National Assembly, the amendment goes to a referendum. And the entire population of Korea gets to vote on it, and it has the right to approve or disapprove of the constitutional amendment by referendum. A majority of the voters have to approve it for it to become a valid constitutional amendment. So that's intended to guarantee the democratic check on bureaucratic authoritarianism reemerging. And after that process, then, the amendment is promulgated or by the president, assuming it passes. So that's the broad strokes of the National Assembly. This leads us into the judiciary. Now, Korea does have an independent judiciary. They consider it to be, in the words of their own judicial publications, it's a three-tier system. But it's a three-tier system with several different types of courts. So if we think of it like the bottom tier is the district, family, and administrative courts. Normally the courts of first hearing for most types of cases. And that includes, obviously, district courts. It includes administrative courts that deal with normal kind of bureaucratic problems. It includes family courts. It also includes basically municipal courts. And even though this isn't included in the normal three-tier, we can assume they do have a parallel military court system, just like in the United States. And there are entry-level district military courts or district-equivalent military courts. We then have the high courts level, the second tier. The high courts tier are include basically three-judge appellate courts. That's most of what they hear are appeals. And there's also parallel to this, an equivalent high court that is a court of original jurisdiction, and that is the patent courts. And then finally, we have a Supreme Court layer. Now, the Supreme Court layer actually has two Supreme Courts. We have a Supreme Court, generically speaking, which is the court of final appeal for criminal, military, civil, all that good stuff. But then we have a constitutional court as well, which has some highly specific kinds of responsibilities. So that's the broad strokes of the outline. A couple things to bear in mind is, in original jurisdiction cases, you're either going to be sent to a court with one judge or three judges, depending upon the severity of the case, like how important it is, how much money is involved, how severe the punishments could be. Appeals courts in Korea and the patent court all tend to have, I believe all of them have, three-judge panels, so they're triumphs. And then we, when we reach the Supreme Court level, it gets a little more complicated. We'll talk about that in a second. There are 18 district courts, but there are also at that level what are called branch courts that have no role whatsoever in appeals processing. And there are 40 of those. So basically they exist largely to kind of take some of the burden off the mainstream district courts. There are six high courts. And this is pretty small, right? And it shouldn't surprise us. It's actually a fair number for a small nation. So that's kind of impressive. So something to bear in mind is the Koreans built their system on a European-style model, especially modeling it after the French and the German systems. This has serious implications. One is it is unlike the United States in that there's very little dependence or use of juries. There's actually a little bit of experimentation with juries right now. But juries are basically not that important in Korea. They're almost non-existent. And if you're an American or from the English-speaking world, you probably are a little shocked and horrified by that. If you're from the Napoleonic tradition, it's nothing too surprising. But you even see further restrictions that kind of reflect the distinct traditions of Korea and how they've picked and chosen. For instance, there are prosecutors are very, very important in the system, but there's very limited access to defense counsel in South Korea. Like when you go to court, you do not have a defending lawyer. The only time you're guaranteed a defensive counsel in South Korea is while you're being interrogated by police or by prosecutors. But for them to even they have to have permission to voice their protests from the prosecutors. So it's a very professionalized bureaucratic system, but it's very alien from the American experience. Judges in the Korean system, on the other hand, again, they're very bureaucratic in their design. They judges are not ever elected, which is, as we all know, comes with all sorts of problems and complications, which is why many countries, and I argue probably most, don't do it. In the United States, it's controversial even where it's done. But to become a judge in South Korea, you pass the National Judicial Examination. And either you have to complete 2 years of special training to prepare you to be a judge, or you have to have been a practicing lawyer. So you have your law degree and you have experience as a lawyer. All judges that serve at any level in South Korea are nominated by the Chief Justice of South Korea, which I find very interesting. Not by the president, not by the prime minister, not by the state council, but by the Chief Justice, and they are confirmed by the Supreme Court Justice Meeting and Council. So the Supreme Court has this role that is, in essence, for lack of a better term, it's administrative, right? Also, the justices serve 10-year terms. All judges, normal judges at least, serve 10-year terms with an option of reappointment. So again, quite different from the United States, where judges, especially federal judges, serve lifetime. And then in other places, the only time we typically see them serve less than a lifetime tenure is if it's a special court or if it is a court that is where judges are elected. So this leads us to those Supreme Courts, and specifically the Supreme Court and the Constitutional Court. So let's talk about the Supreme Court first, and then we'll talk about the Constitutional Court a little bit. So the Supreme Court is, simply put, the Court of Final Appeal. It has a Chief Justice who is appointed for a 6-year non-renewable term, and 13 other Supreme Court justices who are appointed for 10-year renewable terms, just like the regular justices in terms of their term. Now, 12 of those justices, the non-chief justice Supreme Court justices, are adjudicating judges. They work in the process of determining and making decisions about cases. One of them, however, is in charge of the court administration. So there still is Supreme Court justice, and they have that level of authority and specialization and political appropriateness. But they are not working in the process of actually deciding cases. Now, this is there's some interesting stuff here about like how you get to be it and all that. First off, the way you become the Chief Justice of Korea is that you're appointed by the president and confirmed by the National Assembly. On the other hand, the way in which you would become a regular member of the Supreme Court is that you're appointed by the president on recommendation of the Chief Justice. So the Chief Justice will come up with a list of recommendations. The president then appoints from that. And upon appointment, then again, it must be confirmed by the National Assembly. So the Chief Justice is a more explicitly political position than any of the other justices of the Supreme Court. And what that means is that there's a reasonable reason for the non-renewable 6-year term as opposed to the renewable 10-year terms of the regular justices on the Supreme Court. Other things to bear in mind to be on the Supreme Court, you have to be over 40. You need at least 15 years experience as either a judge, prosecutor, or lawyer, or 15 years experience in legal affairs working for a government agency or ministry, or have served as a tenured professor of law in an approved law school. And there is a 70-year-old mandatory retirement age for Supreme Court justices. The Constitutional Court, which is, of course, a kind of Supreme Court, but its competency is limited ultimately to questions that we would say, quote-unquote, are constitutional, specifically determining the constitutional and presidential actions or laws, determining the constitutionality and legality of an impeachment, determining the constitutionality of the dissolution of a party, and, let's see, dealing with constitutional petitions or jurisdictional conflicts between agencies of the government. So basically, it has a much more narrow band of interpretive powers. It's not dealing with regular appeals at all. This constitutional court has 9 members. These 9 members get their offices in 3 different ways. 3 of the members of the constitutional court are directly appointed by the president by him or herself. They're a direct appointment. Nobody can intervene. That's it. 3 of them the president nominates from a list elected by the National Assembly. So it is their nomination is with the National Assembly or concurrent with or in consultation with, however you want to put it. 3 are from a list that is developed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So this is a kind of interesting kind of It's an interesting combination. Also because of the high level of what we might think of as constitutionality being explicitly political, they serve for renewable 6-year terms. They're not there for 10 years. It's shorter. And they, again, like the Chief Justice and the members of the Supreme Court, have a required retirement at 70 years. Okay, this leaves us with one big broad slap of politics left, which is subnational politics. This is going to be very straightforward. We bear in mind that the Korean system is designed as a unitary state. It's nothing too crazy, unusual. So subnational units exist largely for administrative purposes, and they have very limited democratic input. So we have 17 what are called first-tier divisions, or 17 members of the first tier division. These are, we can think of these as generically provincial, right? And these are six metropolitan cities, six very large cities, one quote-unquote special city, Seoul, Korea, one special autonomous city, which is Sejong, which is the administrative capital of Korea as opposed to the constitutional capital. And we have nine provinces. So again, nothing too crazy, nothing too unusual for a unitary state. So basically 17 provincial level administrative systems. These are then subdivided into just a host of different types of smaller second tier administrative units. These divisions kind of can be lumped into two big categories. The bigger ones are municipal, and the smaller ones are sub-municipal. And they're basically divided up in a whatever way is kind of convenient and site-specific. So the municipal divisions include cities, counties, and districts. The sub-municipal include towns and townships, as well as neighborhoods and villages. So really, it's just a question of scale. And obviously, sub-municipal may be underneath of municipal, but are not definitively underneath of municipal. It would depend on the specific geography of the place. And given the high level of unitarism and the limited decentralization, basically, executives for these systems are sometimes elected. They may have councils with limited kind of consultory powers, but that's pretty much it. Which is very interesting because Korea, for a very long time, localities did exercise quite a bit of power. The bureaucratic authoritarian state kind of slowly wrested away that power from localities. And now there's substantial pressure in Korea, as in a lot of other unitary, centralized, democratic republics to once more diffuse power to the local scale. Well, those are the broad strokes, the super fast introduction to the institutions of Korean politics and South Korea, the Republic of Korea. If you have any questions, please email me or call me or communicate with me on Facebook, whatever it takes, and I will help you with whatever you need help with, and be sure to consult your readings, and we'll be back soon. All right, have a lovely day, and I hope you're safe, and you're healthy, and you're happy.